This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Loads of movies to talk about. And what? What are you looking at me like that for?
I'm not. I'm just hanging on your every word. I'm not looking at you in every way, anyway at all.
So amongst the movies that we are going to be talking about at various stages,
yes.
Superhero.
Yes.
Which is a kind of a
superhero movie, yeah.
Leslie Nielsen in that?
Yes, he is.
Gone Baby Gone.
Yes.
But The Waiting Room. Now, the reason why we're going to start at The Waiting Room, apart from that, it's a very good movie, is that Roger Gilby, it's his film, and he's here.
Hello.
And he wants to say as much about it as possible. So over to you.
Yeah.
Tell us about this movie. Tell us about The Waiting Room, Roger.
Well, it's a film about love, about life, about meeting the one, the joy of meeting the right person. It's about romance, today's an extremely exciting day because it's getting distributed.
Can I fill in the holes here for
you? Yes, it's very interesting. You haven't told us anything about it or who's in it.
He can fill in the rest of it. It's basically a story of a group of couples. At the centre of it, we have Anne-Marie Duff, who is a fantastic actress, and yes. I think Roger would agree that you're absolutely lucked out in having Anne-Marie Duff right at the centre of it. And it is a sort of a grown-up drama about grown-up couples having grown-up interactions, but not in an adult way, in the inverted commas sense.
There's some of that.
Yeah, no, there is some of that, but not in that sense. Now, I should have a bit of history here.
Some of that and in that sense.
Thank you. Some time ago, Roger made a short film that was Oscar nominated, and I was working at Radio 1 at the time, and Roger, at that point, he couldn't get this film into festivals for love nor money nor nothing. And then finally, there's this short film called It's Good to Talk, which is a lovely little film. And Roger went to the Oscars, well, I think with a Radio 1 tape recorder, didn't you? You sort of filed back some, because you didn't win, because because you had met me by that point, therefore it was cursed. And after that, Roger said, I'm going to make a feature film. Of course, you got sidelined into doing television. You did that rubbish Robin Hood thing for which you should be thoroughly ashamed of yourself. But finally, the first feature film is here, and this is it. And it's a really good, solid piece of work. And the thing that I was very pleased about is it's one of those terrible things when you sort of say to somebody, it'd be really nice to see your first feature, and then you're absolutely convinced that when you have to finally see it, you'll have to bury your head in your hands because it'll be yet another excruciating British film of the type that we have seen all too many recently.
Yes, that's very true.
And it was a great relief when we saw The Waiting Room, and it's a really, really, you know, well put together film, which absolutely hangs, I think, on a solid script and a very fine performance by Anne-Marie Duff, who I think you'll agree is terrific.
No, she's amazing.
That's what you should have said. Now you go.
The whole thing has just been a joy, really. I mean, it's taken a long time. It's been 10 years coming. But then over the last 3 years that we got the film together, and it came together very quickly. And we got this wonderful cast, Anne-Marie Duff, Ralph Little, who's a revelation in this film. His performance is absolutely...
In every sense.
Do you think he could have kept his clothes on just a little bit more? I did get the sense quite early in the movie that here's a guy who really, really wants to get his kit off and stay there.
Well, he's, you know, I think... He's got nothing to hide, really, so he didn't...
Everyone else is kind of demure. Apart from Ralph.
Moving swiftly on, Frank Finlay's good too.
No, well, it's all wonderful. And what's so exciting for me is that, you know, all I've ever wanted to do is, God, this sounds terribly pompous, but is to tell a story. And to tell a story, you know, what I enjoy about going to the cinema is identifying with the characters and getting involved in the film that you're watching. And that's all I've wanted to do. I mean, from watching my first film, Gregory's Girl was one of the first films that kind of really meant a huge amount to me.
It's a very good starting point.
What's so exciting, again, without sounding too arrogant or pompous, is that I think we've really achieved that. And that... I've watched it and sat in with audiences, and it gets an absolutely a wonderful response. I mean, you know, they vocalise throughout the screening, so they laugh, they go ooh, they go ah, they're moved and connected to it. And I think that is in huge part is down to the cast, who have taken the script on and taken these characters on and made them very real and human and believable. And they're very tricky characters in a way, because they're You know, you're asking people to, you know, that there are relationships, there are husbands and wives and boyfriends and girlfriends, and you absolutely believe that these people are together. You don't doubt it for a second.
But one of the things that's interesting is that when you had finished, when you had made the film, which you know, the problem that you had initially was that it's much easier to get a British film distributed if either it's a hideously bawdy sex comedy or it's a brutally violent story of, you know, gangsters and horribleness.
Yes.
But the problem that you had was it's a film about ordinary people behaving in a fairly decent way, and actually, and there isn't, you know, some kind of, you know, nasty edge to it. And you said yourself, it's much easier to market a British movie if it's got some, you know, shock factor tacked onto it. And the thing about The Waiting Room is it absolutely hasn't.
Thanks, Mark. No, you're absolutely right. But it hasn't got that hook. But what it has got is it's got these characters. It's got real characters that you can connect to. I mean, the trouble is, the reason it took so was a struggle to finance. Everybody loved the script, you know, 5-6 years ago. Oh, we love the script. And if we'd got, you know, I don't know, some A-list ensemble cast, then it might have happened. It's that sort of thing. God, that sounds terrible, because we've got the most amazing cast now.
No, I think Anne really does now constitute A-list, actually.
She does.
Yeah.
So it's sort of... What I'm trying to say is that, yes, you're right in that sense, but I don't want people to be kind of put off because it hasn't got a hook.
No, I don't think anybody should be put off just saying, you know, it's not a movie.
There aren't any underwater chases. No. There aren't any explosions. There's a lot of Ralph Little taking his kids off.
There's one stunt.
Indeed. And some great parenting from Anne-Marie, I think it's Anne-Marie Duff, right at the opening sort of 10 minutes, desperately trying to distract the children, saying, do you want chips for tea? And it works absolutely. On the television goes, do you want chips for tea? That's it. They're distracted.
The other thing that also encouraged me is in the screening that I saw, because I'm 44.
We've got 30 seconds.
I'll be focused. Okay. I'm 44, right? And it clicked with me and I understood. And the thing I was interested in was whether or not it made sense to James King. I don't say this lightly, because obviously he's a lot younger than me. And actually, I was thinking it's a film playing to an older audience. And of course, actually, James is quoted on the poster and really, really loves the movie.
Yes,
so it is interesting that it's not just the middle age bracket into which I absolutely fit.
No, it fits. You know, we get amazing audience responses from all sorts of people. And we get people coming in who say, you know, I only go to the Bond movie or Indiana Jones, whatever, but I've really loved your film. I wouldn't ordinarily have gone to see it, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. So I just, you know, urge, we've got Lionsgate are putting it out. We're in London, we're in Manchester, Reading, and we're going to Ireland, and it's going to go out to the regions in a couple of weeks. And, you know, I just urge people to go and see it.
Roger Golby's movie is called The Waiting Room. Roger, really appreciate you coming in. Box office top 10 this week includes the following. At 10, which seems a logical place to start, that's Sukhar Bannett, the Caramel movie.
The Caramel is called Caramel,
isn't
which
it?
I like very much. I mean, it's a very good, you know, well-told story of a group of women intersecting through a kind of beauty parlour, and it's the caramel of the title is not the stuff you eat, it's the stuff that is used for, what is it called, depilating, when you take the skin off you. No, not the skin, the hair.
Yeah, I don't know, I'll bow to you on that one.
Well, I think, well, it's both sweet but also painful.
Welcome home, Roscoe Jenkins.
Now, lovely, I was away, wasn't I? I was in Cannes and then I was off, so I haven't seen Welcome Home, Roscoe Jenkins, which I believe is the new Martin Lawrence film, so it's obviously top of my list to see.
Speed Racer at 8.
Now, I liked it very much. Here's the one proviso. I now have it on good authority from younger viewers, and I did sort of mention this in my review, that despite the eye-popping visuals and the rest of it, the film is rather too long and somewhat too complicated in terms of its plot for the very young viewers. It is true, there is a lot of stuff in it about corporate corruption, and there is a slight disparity between the whiz-bang candy-coated visuals, which are absolutely great for the and the fact that, you know, they all drink milk and it's a, you know, it's a PG-rated film, and the fact that there is a whole sort of subtext going on about, you know, corporate sponsorship, which I agree those two things don't meld, but I still like it so much more than most critics, and I'm still pleased that people wrote in to say that they'd enjoyed it too, although it is too long.
Forgetting Sarah Marshall at 7,
you know, it's going out of the charts now finally, despite James King's enthusiastic support for it.
Harold and Kumar Escape from Guantanamo Bay.
Now, you see, this is the one that I regret having not seen, because I was often, I don't believe it was press screen. I think it was actually, you know, put out at the very, very last minute.
It was a bad sign.
But Harold and Kumar Get the Munchies, which of course originally in America was called Harold and Kumar at the White Castle, was actually much funnier than anyone would like to admit.
Nim's Island at 5.
You know, not much funnier than anyone would like to admit. Jodie Foster, if comedy is not her forte.
Nim's Island at 5. I've done that. Yeah.
So let's just say it again. Jodie Foster, comedy is not a forte. Am I sending you to sleep?
Nims Island's at 5.
Has it been a long day?
Iron Man at 4.
Bruce Weber back. Well, as I told you, I was taken aside by two parents who had gone to see Iron Man on my recommendation and berated me roundly on the grounds that they thought it was total pants. On the other hand, the teenager that they took to see it had enjoyed it very much. My own considered opinion is that 2/3 of it are pretty solid and 1/3 of it is complete rubbish. I could have lived without Gwyneth Paltrow, and the minute Jeff Bridges puts the suit on and it turns into a Transformers movie, it all falls apart. But, you know, to even have 2/3 of a half-decent superhero movie is quite good. I'm quite looking forward to Incredible Hulk.
What happens in Vegas at 3?
Should stay in Vegas, boom, boom.
Yeah, but you did that last time.
No, I know, but the thing is, there's nothing else.
There must be something else to say.
If you have a movie this unremarkable, right, and it hangs around in the top 10 for this long, it's really hard to there's nothing new to say about it. It's Cameron Diaz and that bloke, what's married to Demi Moore.
At 2, it's Indiana Jones. Peter Ayres on this. Dear Fonzie and Richie, when to see Indiana Jones and the blah, blah, blah.
I take it
Sunday.
I'm Fonzie.
Some, who knows, I guess that's probably right, yeah.
You're Potsy.
I'll be the movie director. Some might see it as an enjoyable bit of fluff, but it's unconvincing, inconsistent, puffed up nonsense, not a slick as they used to be, full of holes and ends unsatisfyingly. Yes, I'm talking about Shia LaBeouf's hairdo.
Yeah, boom, boom.
The film was fun, save for the plot, the motive, character and internal logic magically evaporating towards the end.
I still think, as I said at the time, that it is remarkably unremarkable. It was funny, the amount of emails on the week that it opened from people who were clearly furious about how bad they thought it was. And, you know, my only feeling is, look, really bad is Transformers, okay? And we're not in that level, just because Spielberg does have a kind of functional sense.
I think the last 10 minutes...
Pardon me?
The last 10 minutes is really bad.
Did you think it was really bad?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thought it was fun. I thought it was fun. It was entertaining. Thought it was good. And then I thought, no, this is just stupid. Not that the rest of it was convincing.
Did you not think that that was coming right from the very beginning? Because that's kind of set up in the opening 10 minutes.
Well, only because listeners had been sending in emails going, will you just leave the space alien thing alone?
Well, that, you know, thank you for bringing it up again. I once again was trying to skirt around. No, but I have to say once more, it's not Pirates of the Caribbean terrible. It's, you know, it's not Transformers terrible. But what it is it's so stunningly unremarkable. That in itself is a real problem. I mean, but that said, if you go in with no great investment, I think you have to accept there are things in it that are just passing fair enjoyable. That's all they are.
The box office number one is Sex and the City, and this from John Thacker.
Blimey, Charlie.
Dear Simon,
I mean,
and Mark,
that's a reason to, you know.
My girlfriend Vicky went to see Sex and the City this Monday. She said that it was one of the best films she'd ever seen, though, and she'll definitely be going to see it again, and that she laughed and cried throughout. For some reason, I was a bit disappointed with the predictability of this and decided to tell her that not only did Andrew Collins bang on about it last week.
Did he didn't like it?
Don't know. But also that Mark slated it on the Culture Show. It turns out that I shouldn't have said these things to her. She went ballistic at me, saying that for the first time, Hollywood has made a film about 40-plus-year-old women and that all people like Mark can do is slate it and criticise it. She said that the reviews are sexist, that Mark needs to see Sex and the City film as entertainment rather than approaching it as a piece of cinematic art. I told her that I doubt it was the first time a film would be made from the point of view of older women, but that just stirred the already blazing fire that was my girlfriend's anger. So I ask you, Mark, whether you can defend yourself from these attacks, particularly the sexist reviewer media one, and whether you suggest that there is another better film about 40-plus-year-old women.
Well, I mean, in terms of the, you know, films about 40-plus-year-old women, look at Hollywood before we got to the 1950s, and what used to be referred to as the woman's... No, sorry.
So what, we have to
no,
go
no,
back
no,
to
no,
1940s
No, 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 no,
movies.
We don't. I'm just saying there is this
well,
whole...
before the 50s.
Hang on. This whole idea that actually, you know, films about women of, up until the age of 20. You know, there's that gag in... which movie is it? Is it The First Wives Club? When Goldie Hawn says, you know, in movies, there are three ages of women. I think it's Goldie Hawn. I may be misquoting. She said, and actually The First Wives Club is a very good indication of a movie which is about people over the age of 40, which is perfectly decent. And she said,
can
three
you be
ages
brief,
of women.
Because there's a race in a minute.
Okay, fine. She said, you know, it's Secretary, Mistress and Driving Miss Daisy. That's what it is. That's
are you being sexist?
No, I would like to think that I'm absolutely, you know, because I think on my past record, there have have been many times in which I have been absolutely infuriated by what I perceive as the misogyny and sexism of modern movies. The problem with Sex and the City is not that it's a woman's picture. The problem with Sex and the City is when you compare it to everything else, it's not that it's to do with women. It's that it is a consumerist piece of TV bilge that is badly constructed and badly put together. First Wives Club, I think, is an excellent indication of what this area of cinema actually ought to be about. I mean, the problem with Sex and the City, except for that, it's baggy, it's way too long, it's ill-disciplined, it's woodenly directed, it's morally bankrupt and vacuous. It is a film which spends its entire running time shoving handbags down your throat and then has the gall to say at the end, you know what, there's more to life than handbags. I mean, that's the same moral duplicity that Cecil B. DeMille used to give you 2 hours of filth and destruction with God turning up at the end and saying, oh, the, you know, listen, I mean, that is not a woman's picture,
John.
That is a, you know, a handbag picture. I beg your pardon.
John, I hope that's enough ammunition for you in your continuing argument.
You know,
with
Mrs. Miniver,
Vicky,
I'm sorry. You
that's
know,
enough.
And can I just say, on the issue of product placement, it is disgraceful to imagine that a movie with that level of product placement is somehow representative of women's cinema. I mean, I'm sorry, that is sexist. What's sexist is assuming that that's what women's
just,
cinema looks
it's
like.
Just John's girlfriend, Vicky, raised the point.
Okay, Gone Baby Gone, thriller co-written and directed by Ben Affleck, who, if you remember a while ago, did actually win an Oscar for Good Will Hunting. Remember that, when he went up on the Oscar stage and he was
quite a long time ago now.
No, but for writing it, that was the point. It was a writing. No, it was quite a long time ago, but he is an Oscar-winning screenwriter. I mean, everybody knows him best as Ben Affleck, the movie star. Starring Casey Affleck, who was Oscar-nominated for his fantastic performance in The Assassination of Jesse Jones, which, as we know, remains, you know, my favourite film of last year. Just an extraordinary piece of work. Co-starring Amy Ryan, who was Oscar and Golden Globe nominated. Co-starring Ed Harris, Morgan Freeman, adapted from a novel by Dennis Lehan. He was the guy behind Mystic River. So all these things giving it an extraordinary pedigree, and in fact very, very good reviews when it opened in America. The reason that it's been delayed is because its opening coincided, you know, with the horrible events of the McCann case. And in what I think was a rare episode of sensitivity, it was decided to hold the movie back because, I mean, I think that what echoes there are very, very tenuous, but I think it was genuinely felt for probably all the right reasons. Let's just hold on to the movie. So now it's coming out. Now, it's not that it was held back because it was, you know, disgraceful or in any way, you know,
just being sensitive. Yeah.
Absolutely, which is not a phrase you very often hear in relation to the movie business, that they were just being sensitive. Anyway, so the story is that Affleck and Ryan are Boston detectives who are called in to assist in the case of investigating the disappearance of a young girl because they have local knowledge. This does not please the police.
Captain Patrick Kenzie, this is my associate, Angie Gennaro.
See, Beatrice went on and hired someone.
I take it that wasn't your recommendation.
It was not. That woman would mortgage her home to every snake doctor taking credit cards if she thought it would help find her niece. My job's hard enough without inviting the circus in here.
Captain, this isn't about the money for us.
You ever investigated an abduction before?
I think Mrs. McCready was hoping we could help with the neighborhood aspect of this investigation, the people, you know.
How old are you?
I'm 31.
He just looks young.
Of course, there you heard the voice of Morgan Freeman, who is completely unmistakable. It's an interesting case with the film because, on the one hand, there are things to really admire about it. It does have a genuine sense of location. It has a very downbeat, dour tone, which it manages to achieve a level of seriousness in its opening stanzas, which resonates and which seems to work. And some people have compared it to Mystic River, obviously because of the shared author. There are certainly themes that are shared with it. There is a sense of location which is shared with it, and there is also a sense of overbearing portentousness which it does share with it. Now, what happens during the course of the movie is that the case of the missing girl unravels, and we discover, as Casey Affleck investigates the case, that there are many twists and turns, and nothing is as simple as it seems, and those people who appear to be guilty may not be. And as it goes on, the plot twists and turns become more and more convoluted until we end up in what is frankly an absolutely risible denouement, which is a problem because on the one hand, the movie has a sense of seriousness, a sense of mood, a sense of gloom, a sense of despondency, a sense of genuine atmosphere. But on the other hand, it remembers that it is a thriller, and I don't think it ever quite ties those two things up together. There is also a slight problem, which is that the two central stars appear not to be completely genetically related to their environment, although of course actually Casey Affleck is from around there, but they are very, very, you know, young and handsome and good looking in an environment in which the whole point about it is, we hear at the beginning, I deal with the people that fell through the cracks, and that's what it's about. It's about people at the lower end of the, you know, of the world spectrum, and it has great sympathy for those people, and yet in a way its stars sometimes don't quite hit the right note. All that said, I think there is real evidence of good solid working. I mean, there are many cases in which Hollywood actors, particularly, you know, Hollywood actors who are sort of known for being, you know, handsome Hollywood actors who haven't made some great movies in the past, aren't that great when they get behind the camera. And often actors directing actors just leads to a level of self-indulgence. This isn't self-indulgent. I think there are some scripting problems. I think the story itself is fundamentally flawed, and the flaws in the story come out more and more as the thing progresses. But that said, I think there was much to be impressed by. I think that, you know, Ed Harris is always a very, very watchable screen presence. Morgan Freeman is given a tricky role because, in fact, he is kind of central to what goes wrong with the movie as it unravels in terms of plot. But there is a sense of mood to it. There's a genuine sense of place, and it's been out in America for such a long time now that it's now available on DVD. And interestingly enough, on the American DVD, there's a slightly alternative ending which rather over-eggs the ponderousness of it, and you, when looking at that, you sort of see how much Ben Affleck has kind of pulled back from really falling into melodramatic ponderousness. So much to admire, much to like, you know, enough to be sniffy about, but generally a good solid piece of work, and one which his heart appears to be in completely the right place. Which is, sorry,
you got a couple of minutes, so let's whack
right. Well, which is more than can be said in that case for a couple of other things. Which are, so Prom Night, okay? You remember Prom Night? You don't remember Prom Night?
I don't remember Prom Night.
1980 horror movie, Prom Night.
No,
yeah, no. Okay, fine.
Fill me in.
Well, it's a 1980 horror movie. In fact, oddly enough, had Leslie Nielsen in it. Had a whole bunch of people in it. And there is a lot of
people get killed.
Yeah, yeah. But
I remember that.
But with some sort of set words. So now we have a room because we are now in a peculiar period in cinema, which is that we are remaking all the horror movies from the 1970s, the 1980s, the slasher horror movies from those periods, and we're just taking the titles and remaking them for no good reason whatsoever, except for the fact that they're an established title. Therefore, people will go and see them. So now we get new Prom Night. Okay, story is, it's Prom Night. There's a young girl, sometime in the past, a hideous killer who looks a bit like Charles Manson. He looks a bit like Charles Manson, and that's as far as we're going in terms of subtext, is that the killer looks a bit like Charles Manson, has escaped from the prison, and he's going to come back and ruin the prom night. So, bunch of young people, the ones who are raunchy and racy and get picked off by the killer in no particular order. The person who is the sort of heroine, well, you know how it's going to work out because you've all read the Final Girl stories. You know, you've all read Men, Women and Chainsaws, which I incidentally...
We've all read what?
Carol Clover's Men, Women and Chainsaws.
If we had a straw poll, my guess is we haven't all read
If
that.
We had a straw poll, my guess is that an awful lot of people have.
You changed it. I didn't say an awful lot of people hadn't. You said most of us have. And I'm saying most of us have.
Okay, I will step back and say an awful lot of people will. Anyway, in this day and age, there is no justification for a stupid remake slasher movie to be as dumb, as boring, as cack-handedly put together, as uninventive, as... It's not even that it's derivative. It's like they don't care. It's like they literally don't care at all. And the other great thing about it is, it's a 15. At least before, it was an X. Now, it's just... It's bloodless, it's thoughtless, it's headless. It is just a piece of nonsense. And, you know, if you want to see Prom Night... Go get the original Prom Night on DVD. Believe me, it wasn't that great the first time round.
Movie of the week.
Oh, already?
We're out of time.
I would say, in that case, Gone Baby Gone. I was going to give honourable mention to Mongol, but we can do it next week, can't we? Because it'll still be in the cinemas.
We'll do that. And Serena in Essex says, if you want to see a great film about real women living in a real city, go and see Caramel. Life, love,
yes,
and
well, there
beauty
we go. Thank you very much.
Not to be missed.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.